person who is stepping out. I'm gonna turn around. I'm gonna turn around once, I'm gonna do the eagle run.
Listening to Countess Caroline's Royal Aussie podcast. Ross Wilson is the powering force behind some of the biggest hits of both the 70s and 80s. As a singer-songwriter and musical producer, Wilson has mentored some of Australia's most notable artists for the past 5 decades. In the 70s, Wilson exploded onto the music scene as frontman for Daddy Cool. He then went on to produce 3 albums for Skyhooks, including their debut album, Living in the 70s. Not long after, he was back behind the mic as lead singer of Aussie band Mondo Rock, a band who went from pub rockers to music legends with the release of their 2nd album, Chemistry, also scoring the highest-selling album of the 80s. Wilson's even been animated alongside the Wiggles. So here he is, King Mondo himself, Ross Wilson.
Oh, hi, Lady Caroline.
Hi.
You're having a Royal Aussie podcast, I believe.
I am. It's called CRAP, Countess Caroline's Royal Aussie Podcast. And you're
I don't want you I don't want you to take offence at this, but I'm a Republican. Oh, I'm an Australian Republican, not an American one.
That's okay.
I'd rather have a Republican than you would be out of the job. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay. That's not a problem. Okay, now, as a man whose profession has him spending the majority of his time on the road, away from his family, how have your family coped with having you at home during lockdown?
Well, that's a very good question. The thing was, during lockdown, we had become empty nesters, mostly. For one stage, we had our 20-year-old son living with us, and quite frankly, we would have preferred not to have him here.
Yeah.
You know, because he was still a rather messy young man, and now he's over in LA, so he can make as much mess as he likes. But, well, I mean, we did okay, and we kept in touch with our kids, and when we first moved in, the very first lockdown, the weekend of that happened, we were actually moving into our newly renovated, a brand new house.
Yeah.
So it was like being on holiday. So for us, it was terrific. You know, for the kids, they had their own places, so it wasn't really an issue. So it was great.
Yeah, it must have been good just to be able to spend more time with the family without being on the road all the time.
Oh, well, I like being on the road, but I sort of grappled with that question over the years. For instance, back in when Mondo Rock was like touring incessantly in the 80s, it did have a rather, it could have a negative effect. So there was periods where I was away for like a month, without seeing my wife and my son.
Yeah.
And so eventually we got divorced. And so it probably took a bigger toll on us than I realized at the time. And so I had 8 or 9 or 10 years between marriages. And so by the time it came around to the second marriage, and we started having a couple of kids, I decided to restructure the way I did things. So I made it sure that I was always only away for about 2 or 3, at the most 4 days, and then I'd be back. And that's how I do it now. You know, we play all around Australia, but usually I'm only away for a maximum of about 3 days.
Okay. Now, you've clocked over 50 years in the music industry, and you have two very influential parents. One was your mother, who played piano and violin, and then your father played the trumpet. What impact do you think your parents had on your career?
Well, my mother was also a trained singer, so she had a very good pitch. She had perfect pitch, and so she could, tell a note when you sang it to her. And she was a very good sight reader of music, but she could not improvise, and that's where my father came in, because he loved jazz music and he would play the trumpet, but he didn't play any banjo, and he just did it for his own pleasure. And he had a lot of jazz friends, and they'd come around and they played jazz records, which is where I heard people improvising, just making stuff up over a chord pattern. So I think that probably, when you combine those two things, they both had an influence on me. And I think that my mother, who was had designs on being a singer, a contralto in sort of more classical stuff, just before the Second World War, and then she got married, and then the war kind of stopped any kind of ambitions in that regard as she went off to work for the CSIRO in the war effort. And so then raising the kids, I think in hindsight she might have projected some of her ambitions onto me. So they never really, when I started playing in like rough little rock bands in our garage, they were always quite supportive of that. They never said, oh, what are you doing, what are you going to do for a living, blah blah blah, at least let me get on with it, and let me get better at doing what I was doing. So I really appreciate that, and a lot of parents wouldn't have done that.
Was it your mother that actually pushed you towards the choir?
Yes, she would always go, being a housewife, she loved to sing, and she loved music, just full stop. She loved music, so she loved all kinds of music. But she loved to sing, so she would join whatever she thought was the best choir in the district. And at one particular, and it didn't matter what denomination it was, it could be a Catholic choir or whatever. So she ended up singing at the local Church of England in Hampton. And then my brother was, you know, he was 3 years older than me, so he was quite a good singer too. So he got corralled into being one of the boy sopranos, and then a couple of years later, it was my turn as well. So we used to go and rehearse there every Thursday, and then on Sundays we would sing in the morning, and they had an evening service as well. So we were there twice a day singing in the choir with older people, like people, tenors and altos, and that's how I learned how to sing harmonies, you know, without really even realizing what was happening. They were just going, sing this part and stick to it, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I learned a bit out of that as well.
Okay. Your first musical experience was at the opera, and your first rock concert experience was at a concert called The Big Show, with headline acts such as J.O.K., Buddy Holly and the Crickets, Paul Anka, Jerry Lee Lewis. What do you recall about that event?
Well, that was an amazing event. You know, it was a festival hall, so, a pretty rugged kind of a place to have concerts. But everybody played there. All the jazz guys played there. All the big guys like Frank Sinatra and, you know, Louis Armstrong and that, they all played there. And then rock and roll came along. And Lee Gordon, an American guy who was a promoter in Australia, started promoting shows. And they were always called The Big Show, you know, Lee Gordon's Big Show.
Yeah.
So I was quite aware of those. And I was only about 10 years old, and I already bought like a Buddy Holly and the Crickets single, That'll Be the Day. And so I asked my dad, do you think we can go to this show? And he said, yeah. So him and his mate, who also had a couple of sons about my age, and we're all friends, we all tripped along to see that. And it was like quite an amazing event for me, because it was just like teenagers running up and down, and, you know, going nuts, and Jerry Lee Lewis flicking his hair around and playing a whole lot of shaking going on, and Johnny O'Keefe rolling around on the stage trying to upstage everybody else, and then Buddy Holly and the Crickets, you know. I was like, and I remember thinking, gee, things are getting a bit wild here, and looking around at my daddy, because I'm thinking, gee, maybe he'll make us go home, you know.
Yeah.
I turned around, he had a big grin on his face, he was loving it, you know, so it was fantastic.
I got
to see that show, and then we used to have like daydream about, gee, well, maybe one day I'll be at Festival Hall and I could leap around the stage and roll on the floor like Johnny O'Keefe. You know?
Talking about singles, you've got a huge single collection, I gather, and a jukebox, yeah. I believe.
I have a jukebox. I used to have an original jukebox back in the 80s. It was a 60s one. It kept breaking down, and then the guy who fixed it died, so I couldn't get it fixed anymore.
Oh.
And so I had to sell it, you know, but it was a wonderful machine. And and so when I discovered that there was a company in England making similar jukeboxes that played 45s, and they were the only company in the world doing it, because they already switched to having jukeboxes that played CDs, which for me was like really boring, because I had like a huge 45s collection. And so I scattered around, and I found that the guy who imported them was based in Moorabbin, so I went down there and I got one, you know.
Yeah.
And it's still, I was playing it yesterday, and I stick all my favourite things on there. There's a lot of blues, there's John Lee Hooker, and, you know, it's mainly black music and a bit of funk, and it's all sort of 60s and 70s, a little bit of 80s, and that's about it. But it's just so great to hear the original records played on the kind of machine that they were made to be played on, you know. It sounds great.
Mm. Okay.
Sounds
now,
much better than Spotify and all those, you know.
Yeah. Now, you were in a few bands before the Pink Finks in 1964, where you had material, but the record companies weren't showing much interest in what you were offering. So you decided to create your own label, Mojo, and you released a cover version of Louie Louie, which entered the Melbourne charts.
It did. We were on the charts for about 5 weeks, and I think we got up to number 16. And it was mainly all our, we were a bit of an item around Bayside where we lived, and we're all still at school, you know, but we didn't know anything, so we just thought, we'll make a record, and we put it out ourselves, and the guys who pressed it distributed it. I think we ended up selling a couple of thousand copies, you know.
Yeah.
But that was our start, so we ended up, the Pink Finks going on TV and all that, but we didn't write any songs back then. It was still a little bit later when I started to write songs, when I formed a band called The Party Machine. That's when we started writing songs in earnest.
But then you were invited over to Europe, or you chose to go to Europe?
Hey, you know more about me than anybody else I've ever met. There's a band called Procession who...
That's right.
...who had been Norm Rose's backing band. So half the guys were English and half were New Zealand, I think. And they had seen me... They went to England after a while to try and crack it over there, and they'd seen me playing in the party machine and like my presence and the fact that I wrote songs as well. And so they decided they wanted to have a front man. So I got an invitation to go join them. I said, what the hell, I might as well, you know. And went over and had an incredible time and sort of figured out my place in the world. And came back to Australia with a whole new battery charged and spent about 9 months mucking around before I formed Daddy Cool.
Yeah, and that's when you had your breakthrough hit, Eagle Rock.
Yeah, and then about 4 or 5 months later, we put out Eagle Rock, and that was the beginning of my life as a professional musician, you know, non-stop. I'd been a professional for a little while before that, but there were some breaks in between where I had to go off and get other jobs.
Yeah.
But I'd say that trip to England really changed me, and particularly the trip back where we didn't, me and my new bride, Pat, didn't have any money, so we hitchhiked across Europe, and then when the cars stopped, we jumped on buses and whatever was available and went through the Middle East and Asia and arrived back in Darwin about, you know, 4 months after we'd started, having learned a lot about the world.
Yeah. Talking about Pat, you actually also wrote a song for her, Bop Girl, which was a number two hit in 1983.
Yeah, it was really annoying that it didn't. It would have been number one, except Ostentatious had the mega, mega, mega hit Australiana.
Yeah.
And that kept us off the number one spot. But it was number one in each state, pretty much, but not all at the same time. So it was Ostentatious was you know, a stumbling block there. But it was a huge hit, huge. And it was also a huge hit in the Philippines.
Wow.
And she was about to go over there to promote it when they had all the riots and people power, and they were kicking out the dictator Marcos. And we got a telex saying, because they didn't have internet back then, a telex is what we got, saying, don't come, it's too dangerous. So that was the end of her career over there.
Wow.
But she still gets streamed a lot over there.
Yeah.
That's the two places she gets streamed most is the Philippines and Australia.
Yep. You were performing at the Melbourne University, I believe, where you first got your first look at glam rock band Skyhooks. Is that correct? Was it at Melbourne
Uni? Yeah, well, they weren't really a glam rock band, but they were actually wore sort of glam rocky clothes to take, like they did out, take the piss out of it, you know?
Yeah.
Like they would satirise just about everything, as you could see by their songs. And I heard them and I thought, what's this? You know,
yeah.
They had everything I liked. They were funny, irreverent, and that, you know, they were the kind of things that were the hallmark of Daddy Cool, who'd were just actually reformed for a little while after I saw Skyhooks. And so they had the things that I liked. And the lineup, they didn't have the same singer, they didn't have Shirley at the time, and eventually they did get Shirley. And meanwhile, I've been demoing their songs and signed up Greg McCain's the songwriter to my music publishing company, so I have vested interest, and I was trying to get their songs away, and then when Shirley joined, they became much more likeable, and and there was a lot of interest around then, and they got a deal with Mushroom, and I got the job of producing them. So everything, all the hard work that we put in for 18 months came to fruition. And we made the album Living in the 70s.
Yeah.
And making that album, I'd say, was one of the great musical experiences of my life, because it was so just a creative environment. We all worked well together and we had great songs, and I was able to function as a producer, you know, putting on little touches like synthesizers and bongo drums and extra harmonies and all of that kind of stuff. But they were fantastic to work with, an incredible band.
Well, that was one of the most successful albums of the 70s. But you did two other albums for them as well.
It was the most – Daddy Cool, my band Daddy Cool, had the most successful Australian rock album in 1971, and that sold like 60,000, and eventually over time about 100,000 albums.
Yeah.
In the space of a year, about 60,000. Excuse me. Skogs came along 3 years later with 1974. We released Living in the 70s, and that sold 250,000.
Wow.
Which was like no one could believe it. You know, it was unbelievable. But from that point on, Australian audiences embraced Australian rock acts. So you had then, you know, later on, Chisel and Midnight Oil. It took a while for the others to catch up, but they would sell like 300,000 of each album as well. But Skyhooks and myself, we kind of set the bar, and then other people took over from there, you know.
The one thing I remember about the 70s and 80s was when you listen to an artist, you recognise their voice. These days, yeah. Everybody sounds the same. Everybody wants to be Beyoncé and hit those high notes. You know.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, it's just crazy.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. There are a lot of good singers around, but you still have to have your own personality, you know, your own voice print.
Yeah.
And, you know, for example of that, I'd say Shirley Strong, you know. You can tell him a mile off, you know. Or someone like Johnny Cash, who's like not a trained singer, but was so distinctive and could sell a song. You know, it's one thing to sing a song, but you've got to actually sell it. You've got to inhabit that song. It's not enough just to sing high notes, you know.
Yeah.
And go off. And then there's a lot of acts I see where people have got really good singers, but I end up sort of walking away, ho-hum, what's that, you know. But you want someone who's distinctive. So I'm glad you asked that question.
Yeah. Then you fronted Mondo Rock, and your second album, Chemistry, was the highest selling record in the 80s.
Yeah, well, there we are. I did it again.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've had a very, very impressive resume here.
The only thing I'm a bit ashamed of is I haven't released an album recently, so I'm going to do that very soon.
Oh, so you've been working on some new material already?
Yeah, I've got lots of new material.
Oh, I didn't know that you actually wrote A Touch of Paradise and recorded that before John Farnham.
Well, when I was putting Mondo Rock together, I hadn't even named the group. That was the first song I wrote for the group I was about to form, you know. And I went around to a friend's place who was a good lyricist, Gulliver Smith, and said, "You got any lyrics?" And he said, "Here, have a look at this." And he had a big pile of, you know, handwritten kind of poems and lyrics, and I was flicking through. And I came to one called A Touch of Paradise. Mm. And had a couple extra verses. It was too long. So I just picked up the guitar. I said, "That looks pretty good." And I just started strumming away and singing the lyrics that were on the page.
Yeah.
And then by about an hour later, after I'd sort of worked out a few more chords, we had the song. That was that.
Wow.
And I went home. And we started rehearsing this new group, which was only a part-time thing at the time. My agent rang up. He said, "What are you going to call it? Got you this big gig." And I said, "I'll call it Ross Wilson's Mondo Rock." He said, "Okay." So at the very first gig, we played that song.
Wow.
So Mondo Rock were the first guys to play it. We played it for a few more years, and the band evolved. We finally got to record it on the album after the Chemistry album, Nuevo Mondo. So yes. There it was on side two, kind of buried away. Mm. And then a few more years went by, and the publishing went through. I had owned my part of the publishing, and my sometime partner in crime, Glenn Wheatley, who I had a label with for a while and a publishing company, he owned Gulliver Smith's portion of the song. So every time someone would come in, like a solo artist like Glenn Shorrick or John Farnham or anyone, he would go, "Why don't you do Touch of Paradise?" You know?
Yeah.
And they'd have a stab at it or whatever. So Farnham finally got around to doing Whispering Jack.
Yeah.
And he knew the song already because he'd seen us play it live. And he had Wheatley going, "You should do this song." And he had my manager, who was a friend of Mondo Rock's manager at the time, was a guy called John Blanchfield, who was also a friend of John Farnham's. He's saying, "You should do A Touch of Paradise." So he had all these people. He goes, "Okay, I'll do it."
Well, it was a huge success.
And he did a very distinctive version.
Yeah,
and so I'm very grateful to him because it got covered all around the world from other artists and stuff because of that.
Wow. Now I have to ask this question. How does it feel to be a performer on the stage and then when your fans hijack your songs and basically perform them for you?
In what way do you mean?
Well, they start singing your songs back at you and take
oh, I love
over
that.
the song.
No, I love that because that's what music to me is all about. It's not about like me and my band on the stage sort of going at people.
Yeah.
We're actually doing it with them. You know, it's a communal thing. Music's always been community.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's, you talk about I started off singing in a church choir, you know, people from the neighbourhood come, that's community.
Yeah.
I started playing in teenage bands at local halls, you know, little teenage dances so that we could amuse ourselves, you know, and that's the same thing. And so I've always kept that in mind. And one of the reasons I love black music, you know, black American music or even, you know, African American music is because basically it's about crowd and response and being part of it, you know. And you ask it, so many black American singers and musicians, where did you start? They go, I started singing in church.
Yeah.
You know, they've got better church choirs than we've got, I've got to say. But
yeah, of course.
Yeah, I would have loved to be part of those churches. I mean, pretty wild. So, like, that's where quite a – so that's community. And so when I get on stage, that's how I feel. You know, I can't do it without an audience. It'd be, I wouldn't be able to make a living. So I'm very, very grateful to having those audience there. And if they know the songs and they want to sing them back to me, I just love it.
Okay, and congratulations on being inducted into the ARIA Hall of Fame twice. Going for the triple?
Well, twice. Once with myself as a solo artist.
Yeah.
And once with Daddy Cool as a group.
Yep.
So now I'm trying to get, you know, I'm waiting for Mondo Rock to get inducted, and then I'll be the only guy that's in three times.
Well, that'll happen very soon, I'm sure.
Well, with your help, I hope.
Well, you're currently touring as Ross Wilson and the Peaceniks and will be performing down at Regional Victoria as part of the series of concerts by Premier Artists being held at the Bellarine Estate Winery just off the Port Arlington Highway opposite Ker Lewis Golf Club. Along with other artists such as the Black Sorrows, Daryl Braithwaite, the Shantuzies, the shows are going to go on for every Saturday and Sunday, excluding Christmas. And you're actually scheduled for Sunday the 12th of December at 12 p.m. What can we expect from your performance?
Well, we've got a great lineup. It's a fantastic lineup, which is tried out already at a winery near Avoca last week.
Right.
And we've got myself, Ross Wilson, and the Peaceniks, and we play some Daddy Cool, some Mondo Rock, some new stuff, some few surprises, and supported by the Bad Loves, who are just a great group. They're sounding fantastic. They're a little bit more bluesy than my band. And Michael Spivey out the front, you might remember them in the 90s. They had Green Limousine and Slave and a few others.
Yep.
And The Weight with Jimmy Barnes on his Flesh and Wood album. That was a big hit. And then opening the day is King Canyon featuring Jimmy Couples on vocals. And the guitarist that we share, James Ryan, is one of the best guitarists in Australia. So it's going to be a great afternoon. We've already tried it out, that format, like I said, at another winery, so we know what we're doing. And that everyone was, by the end of the day, everyone was jumping around and kicking up the dust. So come and have some food, wine and music and a good time. That's what I reckon.
Yeah, and the tickets can be purchased at bellarinemusicfestival.com.au. Thank you, Ross, for allowing me the time to do this interview. I really appreciate it.
Great. I hope to see you on Sunday the 12th.
I'll be there.
Terrific.
Okay, thank you.